Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast, where we explore how to center our lives and our leadership in the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ.
In the midst of the disruptive cultural shockwaves of the 21st century.
Join us as we learn to take the love of God seriously as the force that holds all of us and everything together.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Gravity Podcast. It's just Ben here for the intro. At least Matt and Christy are on vacation, and so I am recording this intro in our little online studio all by myself. So it's just us for a few minutes before we get started on the main part of our podcast. I just want to bring your attention to a couple different things before we get started. One is that we've talked a little bit about this retreat, but we have a retreat coming up in August. It's Labor Day weekend, essentially. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, August 31st through September 2nd here in Indianapolis at an urban retreat center owned by some friends of ours. It's just a retreat. We're calling it A Bright Sadness, making space for grief and joy. So there's not going to be a ton of teaching at this retreat. It's going to be time. It's going to be prompts and time for attendees to process maybe some of the unprocessed feelings from the past few years. Again, as the title implies, both joy and grief. And then just a lot of space for us to talk about that, for us to share with one another in a safe environment. I'm going to be cooking, and we are limiting the retreat, obviously, to the number of people that I feel comfortable cooking for. It's actually going to stretch my capacity a little bit because we have made room for 12 people at this retreat. There are three spots left. So yeah, go and check it out. One thing about the three spots that are left is you will need to arrange your own lodging. The retreat center is full. And so if you want to come, you will need to arrange your own lodging. But there's some links to different places that are near the retreat center there. So again, August 31st through September 2nd, if you'd like to join us for a intimate retreat with home-cooked meals and lots of time to talk about the last few years. And just what it brings up for you and time to process that together. Anyway, we're looking forward to it. And you can check it out. There's a link in the show notes, or you can go to abrightsadness.eventbrite.com. Abrightsadness.eventbrite.com. The other thing, the other little blurb to let you know about is that today's episode is about Shiny Happy People, not the REM song. Unfortunately, that one's a lot more fun than the documentary series that we're going to be talking about. And so we invited some friends, old and new, Rebecca Mui and Laura Robinson, to chat about this documentary series. And our conversation kind of went all over the place. It was a lot of fun, and it was very wide-ranging. And we actually we sort of touch on the documentary series, but we end up talking a lot more about the wider themes that the documentary series brings up, different things that are happening in culture right now, how our faith relates to all of that stuff. So it's a great conversation. It's longer than usual, as you could maybe see from the runtime on this podcast, but I hope you'll listen through it. But one thing to let you know about is that we are going to be podcasting through each episode, kind of episode by episode. We're going to podcast through Shiny Happy People, and then we're going to walk through that Hillsong documentary as well. But we're going to do this on a different podcast platform. We are going to be very soon relaunching what was called the Gravity Commons, where people could, where basically you'll be able to get access to this other podcast that we're going to be doing, where we walk through things like this. It's just a little bit more raw, a little bit more vulnerable platform for us to host some of those things. So anyway, that's the just something to watch for. It's going to include a lot more ways to interact with people. There goes my dog. Somebody's coming to the door. A lot more ways to interact with people, others in the community, and basically access to, you know, all of our past Learning Lab archive, access to join live podcast recordings. We're going to have a new course, a live course where we walk through kind of a deep dive on Axiom 7 from our book, where we talk about reckoning with power and how God's love does that. specifically in the realm of gender and how it shows up there. So anyway, watch for all of that. It's coming soon, more concrete announcements, but just wanted to tease the first few episodes of the extra podcast that we're going to be offering to members of that community for y'all, because we're going to be talking about Shiny Happy People, this documentary series. All right, I think that's all that we need to chat about before we get into this conversation with Rebecca Mui and Dr. Laura Robinson. Here we go.
Rebecca Mui and Dr. Laura Robinson join us today on the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Rebecca is a PhD student in political, social, ethical, and cultural thought at Virginia Tech and researches post-colonial political theology, Christian anarcho-pacifism, and Anabaptism. She's the editor of The Kingdom Outpost and publishes personal essays on her Medium, medium.com at Rebecca Mui. And she recently published a review of what we're talking about today, Shiny Happy People, on Kingdom Outpost, entitled Wholeness or Whitewash? Wholeness and Whitewash, a review of Amazon Prime's Shiny Happy People. We're also joined by Dr. Laura Robinson, who has a PhD in New Testament Studies at Duke University, and she works in public education in Indianapolis and writes and blogs at Laura RBNSN. Laura, Rebecca, welcome to the podcast.
Hi.
Well, let's do this. Let's start with maybe some personal anecdotes. I mean, we're obviously talking about this documentary that Amazon Prime published, Shiny Happy People, four-part series. Some of our listeners, many of our listeners have already seen this, but this may give you an introduction to what it is and let you know if you want to see it or not. But tell us a little bit about your personal upbringing, and the content of the documentary focuses on the Institute for Biblical Life, IBLP stuff with Bill Gothard and the Duggars. So tell us a little bit about your experience with that growing up. Was that a part of your life? Did you know about that, et cetera?
So I grew up in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, and my family just started homeschooling for educational reasons when I was about 9. And it was mostly because like public education and wanting to have a more like holistic, like play filled childhood. And that was great, but there weren't many homeschoolers around. So when I was about 12 or 13, my parents thought it would be great to bring us to a Christian homeschool conference. Turns out it was an ATI regional conference. When the letter first came in the mail, I thought it was the strangest thing ever. You had to wear a specific type of modest court shoes. You had to have khaki skirts down to a certain length. And yeah, like there is a whole bunch of things. And they were going to teach us about like godly courtship and the evils of rock music. And my mom was like, a little bit strange, but you know what? You can go and make friends with other homeschoolers in the region. And so when we went, there were homeschoolers from Indonesia and Singapore, Malaysia. So it was this thing. And there was a lot of people at that conference. They had people come over from the US and they had a lot of the things that you would see. I think there was a regional conference in one of the Duggar episodes. They taught pretty much those things. Like the first lesson was, thou shalt not keep secrets from your parents. And they made all the children, all the girls, because girls and guys were separate. All the guys went outdoors and did fun things. And the girls stayed in like the hotel and did delicate ladylike things. It was very compliment, like very, very complimentarian. And I didn't like, why can't I be out there? Like, anyway, one of the first things they got you to do is assign this thing where you had to make a vow never to keep a secret from your parents. Stuff like that. And so that, and then from like that conference onward, like our church that we joined started, like, was like really into that. So we had basic seminars. The Bill Gothard's advanced seminar was one of our church camps. We had the curriculum and we would go for like the yearly conferences, and they had kind of cool like homeschool groups. It was weirdly gender segregated. Like I tried playing basketball, and then I was like told that like girls do not play basketball, you know, with the guys. Girls do not go camping. Girls don't do outdoors things. You know, you have to like learn how to sew. And yeah, I mean, it was fun. That was our social life for a couple of years. And I got involved in like the conferences, the weekly groups. So in terms of, we never joined ATI, and in our home, we didn't do a lot of those things. But it was in our church, the whole like, there are just weird niche things about ATI culture, like reading the 5 Psalms and 1 Proverbs in some weird order. I don't know if you guys ever heard of that.
Yeah, there's a reference to it, I think, in the documentary. Can you tell us what that is and what the significance of that is?
So, yeah, that was a big thing in our church. And I remember questioning it once and getting in trouble, because basically Gothard had this thing where you read Psalm 1, 31, 61, 91, and 121, and then you would do that the whole month. And then you read 1 Proverbs. And they called it wisdom searches. And a lot of ATI families would do that in the morning. We did that sometimes in our church meetings, Bible studies. It was so weird. And I said, like, you're jumping all over the book of Psalms, and then people say, oh my, it's so amazing because they make more sense, like they were written to be read this way. So yeah, that was just one of the weird niche things. We did the character first curriculum in our church, and I know like a lot of people have this experience, like even if they were never enrolled in ATI, you would like a lot of evangelical churches or groups or whatever would have had some of the books, the character sketches, the whatever. So this thing was not in some weird niche little cult world. It was something that a lot of people, you know, people that I would know, like evangelicals in Canada or something, be like, oh yeah, we went for those conferences. Like there's a, it's like, I call it like a diffusion across the evangelical world.
Yeah.
And sometimes people don't even know like the Psalms and Proverbs thing. I know where it comes from, but people who learn it from somebody don't actually know where it comes from.
Yeah. I want to get into that a little bit later, Rebecca, and maybe explore some of that diffusion. There is this response I'm seeing to the documentary of some people are distancing their tradition from what's going on with the Duggars and Bill Gothard, or trying to say that this is an attack against Christianity, those kinds of things. But I think what you're naming is important, and that is, there is so much diffusion of what was happening in Gothard's movement throughout white evangelicalism in the West, and it sounds like even in Malaysia as well. And so I want to get back to that. But you want to say more about that right now?
I just want to say, like, I would say that I emerged from a relatively conservative fundamentalist-ish influence world. And then I realized that the evangelical world, like, I realized it's all... It's all the same. I mean, like, you may not have had Gothard's version of courtship, but maybe a lot of kids in mainstream churches read George Harris's version, which is the same thing, just in different degrees. Or, like, Focus on the Family teaches many of the same gender things that Gothard would have. So, like, or Desiring God or the Gospel, like, the authority teachings are the same. So, like, people trying to distance is like, come on.
Yeah, the theological social architecture is same foundations, just different maybe wallpaper. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Laura, by way of introduction, what was your growing up like as it relates to this stuff?
Yeah. So I mean, I have a sort of all over the place experience growing up, that I had been raised in a very small Quaker church, actually, in Indiana, on the west side of Indianapolis, out towards Hendricks County, in the more agricultural area. And this was a really small church that had a lot of the hallmarks of Quakerism, right? You know, that there was Quaker families tend to put a lot of stock in education, specifically education of daughters. I have two aunts and my mother from that side of the family, and all of them have PhDs. And now I have a PhD, right? Like, this is a really big part of Quaker history and Quaker families, that education for daughters is a really big part of the culture. And we had female pastors growing up, right? This was not a weird thing. My parents had something of a born again experience when I was in my early teens. And at that point, there was some, this was sort of our first venture into the American evangelical monoculture in a lot of ways, that they were very eager to have churches that had more, more deliberate programming for boys. Right. And we ended up at a large evangelical church in the suburbs. And that was sort of how my evangelical story started, was being in a church that was in some ways very similar to the one we had left, but in some ways extremely different. And a lot of that was the American evangelical emphasis on gender. So I think the way I often talk about this, spending my teen years and college years in this, is that I really had one foot in, one foot out, right? That on one hand, my mom was going to be damned before her kid got married at 19 to a guy going to Bible college, right? Like, that was never going to happen. But at the same time, there was this idealization of that culture. And, the way wealth interacts with this is really interesting, because you simultaneously have this emphasis on like gender roles and, men providing and these sort of like very, like women in my church read the Pearls, right? Like Debbie Pearl. And like that was around. And also, a lot of the women there were lawyers, and, it's a strange combination. And I think that when you're a teenager and you're trying to process this and make sense of this, there's a lot of things pulling on your attention. That on one hand, there's this sense that you want to please your family and you want to do what you're, what is expected of you as a member of a educated suburban social class. And also there's this really strong sense that real Christians would not be doing this, right? That this is something I've called before the superlative bias in evangelicalism, that there's often this like constant attraction to extremity and doing things more than and doing things bigger than. And I think that that was always sort of lurking on the outskirts of this, even if, even if my ability to fully participate in this didn't really fit with my family, there was always this sense that there is a path towards what it means to be a good woman and achievement is somewhat at odds with it, right? And again, it's like, it's tough because I know people are going to listen to this and say, but your church was really celebratory when you went on to get your MA in biblical studies. It's like, and that's all true. That's all true. It's also part of the complicated reality of being in high-performing, high-achieving, wealthy, white, suburban spaces, and also being in spaces that are evangelical and are, the diffusion thing is really intense here, right? That the other part of this is that the spigot that releases the Pearls in, people talk about the Pearls as a fringe group. Okay, sure, but they were still there. The spigot that would block off these impulses, or these like extreme hierarchical teachings, it was still there.
Yeah. Could you say something about the Pearls for those of us, for the listeners who aren't familiar with them? That has to do with like corporal child punishment. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's definitely part of it. I'm not an expert. Honestly, this is like half remembered stuff from 15 years ago. It's a very, there's a strong emphasis on child corporal punishment. There's a strong emphasis in like the role of woman is like help me, which is defined in this very particular, like the satellite that revolves around your spouse and like provides him with support and encouragement and, never makes him upset, a lot of this is, the presentation in this package is very extreme, but it's not meaningfully different from what you see in like Love is Respect, right? I mean, Love and Respect, the Egerich marriage manual that has sold a bajillion copies, right? It's not meaningfully different from that. This idea that there isn't a hierarchy in the home and everything flows towards the husband, right?
Yeah. Right. Christy, as you're listening to Rebecca and Laura, like, I wonder if you can chime in. It strikes me that your experience may be somewhere between Rebecca and Laura growing up.
Yeah, it is. It's actually probably more towards Rebecca. I went to the Bill Gothard things like as a kid. I remember in sixth grade going, thousands of people there. And my dad's dad was like a Baptist preacher, pastor. And so some of that influence like filtered down into the generations. Anyway, as you're talking, you know, when you're a kid, you don't even know that it's how bananas it is until later. And now you're like, oh my gosh, like I kind of feel sick to my stomach watching this or talking about this or, you know, whatever. The veil is kind of pulled off your eyes. And so I am curious, Rebecca, just can we talk about the documentary just for a minute? I'm curious, what was your reaction? Like, how did it impact you? And Laura, Matt, I would actually like to hear your answers too. Like maybe like 30, 60 seconds, like, how did you react and how were you impacted?
I had a thought, just to circle back to something Laura said, that I remember. So recently I did a paper on imperial masculinity in the evangelical world. And there was a study, and there are several studies that I could send you guys if you want to read it. But there are studies about how in evangelical homes where the mother is working, she ends up having a lot of guilt because the biblical womanhood ideal is there. And it's always at the back of her mind, even if she's working as many hours as her husband is, she will do more than double the amount of labor and childcare. And she will always have that guilt that she's not doing enough and not spending enough time with her children, despite the fact that she probably is actually spending more time with her children than a mother in 1950 would, who's staying at home. And there are even there is a study of women preachers in Pentecostal settings who are ordained and who serve and minister, but at the back of their mind there's this biblical womanhood ideal. And so when this academic was interviewing this woman preacher and it came out, she wanted to clarify one thing. She's like, I am a mother first. I bake my own bread. I do. And then she lists all the, you know, homemaking things that she does, because she felt that she had to clarify and prove herself to be a good biblical woman, even though she's literally in an egalitarian denomination. So this ideal that's on women does not just apply to people who are in like fundamentalist homes with 10 homeschool children and the mom stays at home all the time. This is something that women carry, even if they have a full-time job, they need to work, or even if they're in an egalitarian setting where they are preaching.
Yeah. So that's me.
Yeah.
I mean, Rebecca, that is me. It's in my bones. Like, I have to fight it. Like, I'm in an egalitarian setting. I'm a female pastor. I preached on Sunday. I have six kids. And I guarantee you, like, the thing I feel guilty about, the junk inside, because it's like in my bones because of how I grew up and what I was taught and what I believed. Like, it's at the core. And so it's something that I feel like we have to remind ourselves of truth over and over and over and over, because otherwise we just revert back to what we were taught as a kid.
And it actually is a sociological thing in American society. There's this thing called studies on the rise of intensive mothering that has to do with the rise of capitalism. Mm-hmm. And the more that men became economically like the wage earning and all that, the more the ideal of the godly, like the domestic pure woman in the home who's as selfless as possible. And so it's set up. This motherhood is set up so that women can never win unless they literally destroy themselves. And like literally, you have to literally die for your children and then you're a good mother. So like Elizabeth Elliot says, like womanhood is the essence of femininity, is making yourself nothing. That literally is a secular capitalist thing, actually.
Wow. Well, Rebecca, I still want to hear your reaction to the documentary. Like, what did you think? How did it impact you?
So I would say there is nothing really new about the documentary. I had been following one of the survivors, Emily Anderson. She has a Facebook page called Thriving Forward. I had followed the news about all this. There was Recovering Grace, Homeschoolers Anonymous. I was very aware that within this like fundamentalist homeschool world, that there was a lot of sexual abuse that had come out like a long time ago with like the Vision Forum that was more towards the reform side. Mm-hmm. The Pearls never really had that level of scandal, but we all know their teachings are totally messed up. So that's Mike and Debbie Pearl. And then, so when I was watching this documentary, it was like, it said a lot of things out loud that had already been true and had already been what I had processed, seeing like the fruit of the authority teachings, the fruit of the gender teachings, you know. And I think it hit me more than I thought it would have, because I have dealt with a lot of these things and processed them and written about it and talked about it at an academic conference, like in a very intellectual way. But really, like, that the Duggars are just one story. I know so many more stories and like really, really terrible stuff that has happened. And I would call, like, I believe that the authority teachings, whether it's Gothard or CBMW, the Council of Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, whether it's going back to Rushdoony or even all the way back to Augustine talking about patriarchy and slavery in the home, similar to what Doug Wilson talks about. Like, I believe that all of this constitutes grooming for abuse and exploitation. That's what it amounts to, because you're idealizing a woman or somebody under authority who is as meek and subservient and apologetic and obedient, and who, like, they're with the Gothard thing, like, they were talking about how the guilt and shame is internalized. It's like they with their Journey of the Heart conferences and all that, like, they take those things and they implant it in your conscience and in your heart, so your authority always has that lever they can pull or that button they can press to control you from the inside, to use guilt. And, like, you know, you believe that you are sinful and you are rebellious, even if you're like a 30-year-old woman who stays at home because a parent wants you to. She will always believe that she just isn't obedient enough. That literally is true for so many people I know. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just rules. It's not just like these weird exteriors. It's also this spirituality of extreme obedience and surrender. And like, there was a clip in the documentary where Gotham was like, you have only one life. Are you going to live it for what matters? Are you going to live for Jesus? Like, this is very evangelical sounding stuff. They're using this language and they're using the spirituality to trap people and to groom them for abuse and silence.
And now, a word from a sponsor. All right, let's get back into our conversation.
Man, I now realize I feel like we have to have 4-part series on this whole thing, because we could talk for hours on this. Laura, I want to hear, though, what was your reaction? Was it similar to Rebecca's or was it different?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that part of why, you know, I front load all this with, you know, I think that, like, my big takeaway is that it's not as far away as people think it is. That's my big takeaway with all this. And that's why I really front load the fact that I did not grow up on a homestead with 17 kids. I did not grow up going to Bill Gothard seminars. I was not homeschooled. I went to a public school. I went to college. I got a PhD. And this was still familiar. You know, this was still familiar. Yeah. That this is not, and I think if there was something I could really encourage people both in and out of the evangelical world to realize, is that, like, if you start hunting around for this stuff, you're probably going to find it closer to home than you think. And I think that's, if I could really just center on one thing, that would be the primary thing, that it's very, I think the common response to this is that this is extremist, that this is an extreme movement, that this is a fringe movement. This is not representative of American evangelicalism, and we don't need to treat it as though it is. But the reality is that this stuff might be in your church library. There might be somebody on staff at your church who was taught this in seminary. And I'm not saying witch hunt. I'm just saying be aware and keep your ears open. I remember when I was in grad school, watching my pastor speak at a conference, and like some of the books he had recommended on like family life. I remember one of the, I couldn't tell you the name of the book. I'm sure it's on video somewhere, but I remember somebody raising their hand at the end of it and saying, you know, like, I know that book, and the author recommends that that dads shouldn't ever be expected to change diapers, that this would be like a disruption of the family hierarchy and a disruption of the family order. And, you know, like just encouraging this level of like coldness and distance, and like these ways in which like dads shouldn't have to get their hands dirty in parenting. You know, like this isn't just destructive for women. This is destructive for children to not see their parents as equally invested in their nurturing. And I remember him being like, you know, well, yeah, don't take everything on board. But I say that to say that, you know, it's the extreme language is closer to home than people think. And like, you know, you might have a pastor who seems very normal and not crazy, but these ideas are still out there and they're still influencing people. And a lot of times I think what takes over is, you know, what I've called the evangelical superlative bias is that people might not openly engage this stuff, but it's a little bit of the whole, you know, no enemies to the right, or like you also hear it in Love, I guess, but like this idea that more conservative and more traditional expressions of evangelicalism always deserve a hearing because they are more conservative, because they're more traditional, and this and like they're sort of maximizing on something that is useful in the culture wars. And I think what I would just say is just to be aware of that. You know, you might not see it unless you're in pastoral counseling. You might not see it unless you take like a marriage course at your church or a parenting course at your church. And then you might really start to see it. You might really start to see this stuff out there. And I think that's just something to be aware of, that being at a big church with a lot of money and a lot of MDs and JDs does not mean that your church is not influenced by these teachings.
Yeah. Matt, tell us, I mean, before we hit record, you were like, ooh, I'm kind of still reeling a little bit, maybe. I don't know if that's emotionally, but like, tell us, how did you react?
So I was raised Roman Catholic, and none of this stuff was on my radar really at all. I didn't grow up in a purity culture or sort of focus on the family, Bill Gothard stuff. But when I became a Christian in college, like within 6 minutes, somebody handed me I Kissed Dating Goodbye, you know, figuratively. Like this was the now. So I just kind of accepted a lot of the mm-hmm. Bill Gothard architecture as this is what it means to be a Christian. And it didn't really fit me, but I sort of just kind of made room for it, like over here on the side. And then, you know, as a pastor, I remember about 13 years ago, I got into loggerheads, which is a nice Midwest word that means fight, with this elder at this church who we did not see eye to eye. And he was a huge Bill Gothard guy. And he handed me the umbrella illustration, all this stuff. And I remember thinking, this is dumb. But I regret, this isn't right. But I regret I didn't understand as yet how destructive and damaging it was. I just thought it was wrong. I didn't know that it was harmful in the way I do now. So as I watched, I mean, I just was seeing like the normalization of, like you said, Rebecca, predation, grooming, brainwashing, torture, authoritarianism, and all of it sanctioned and endorsed by like Jesus. And so I get like angry when I see that, because like you're messing with my Jesus. That's the first thing. But the second thing is all of that stuff, you know, for the last 8 years since the rise, like since the rise really of the Tea Party, but then Donald Trump, all that stuff's just been embraced by millions and millions of white evangelicals. And I know a lot of our listeners are heartsick over that, you know? But this documentary, I think, helped me be like, oh yeah, this makes total sense now. Like Bill Gothard was like the older brother that was like the successful shiny, happy version. And Donald Trump is like the younger brother who's the rebel, but they're embodying the same kinds of stuff. And I think that it made sense to me in a really devastating way, I guess, as I watched it. And what I mean by like, I feel like it did me dirty. Cause like there's these phrases and moves in that documentary where you've got, you know, things like rape and, child grooming and just the evil, the gratuitous evil that, it still makes me like sad, like really sad that this was done in the name of Jesus, you know?
Yeah.
Makes me sad.
It makes me want to throw up.
And punch something. I'd like to hear from Rebecca and Laura, like, why is this stuff so appealing to us? You know, like Bill Gothard and Focus on the Family kind of grew strong in like the 70s and 80s. What was it about that cultural moment? Why does this appeal so much to people? And then why are they so reticent to reject it when it produces all kinds of bad fruit? What are your thoughts on that? Or do you have thoughts on that?
I think one place I would start is that misogyny didn't need to be invented, but it's always possible to capitalize on it. That would definitely be I think that this is not separable from the fact that we just generally do live in a very sexist society, and that has not changed. I think that there is something. So I think there's two parts, right? You know, people talk a lot about the idea that people love to have like in an uncertain world, in times of economic uncertainty or international instability, that people like roles and rules. And that's true, I suppose, but I would also want to put a lot of asterisks after that, because it's not true that in times of uncertainty, any rule is appealing, right? You'll notice that the movements that did not take off weren't, what if women were in charge of everything? And what if the most important thing in any household was child flourishing, and anything anyone does to get in the way of a child's flourishing is severely punishable and we can throw you out of our community, right? No. Those are not the rules that take off. The rules that take off are the ones that I think affirm the tendencies we already have in our society, which is that, I think this does dovetail with economic problems, right? Is that I think that we acculturate young men to think of themselves as owed in a lot of ways, right? And I'm not trying to dog on young men who might be listening to this. You know, I don't always think this is conscious, and I don't think this is always evenly experienced, right? Lots of people know better. And at the same time, there is a cultural tendency to teach men that they are owed something, and that a significant portion of what they're owed is non-competition in care and support and acts in sexual access to women. And I think when somebody comes along and says that this, you know, these large cultural narratives and motifs like Christianity and, the need to find like your purpose in society, the reason why I think in large part why they catch on with there's so many people out here bemoaning the fact that like, you know, men don't really go to church, but then these programs get men excited about church. Well, yeah, this is affirming cultural narratives about what men are owed. And like, this is appealing. It's appealing to be told that you actually are owed this. You actually do get this, mm-hmm. and you deserve this. And if the women in your life are not providing this for you, then they really need to be corrected. And in fact, like, God has a design for women, and the design for women is exactly the kind of woman who agrees you're owed, and it really takes what you're owed seriously and makes that a priority for her. And I think that that's important. You know, like, we could talk about, you know, like backlash and like the rise of like, you know, 1960s and second wave feminism, that kind of thing. But I also think generally, you know, backlash against women has always been with us. This is not a new phenomenon. That there has always been this frustration women not going with the script. You know, you can find records of this in the Victorian era. You can find records of this in the Roman Empire. Like, this is not a new phenomenon. This idea that we are owed and women are not giving us what they owe us and we need to fix this problem. This has always been with us. This has always been a way of conceptualizing women. So I don't know. I think that like my... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Laura, your comment about how men are owed, and so this flows from that sort of entitlement, right? I was talking to a friend whose teenage son, he told me that he was getting into Jordan Peterson, who's the, you know, the Canadian psychologist, the guy who is basically kind of a white man entitlement embodied, you know? And his comment was, yeah, do not go to his Bible study. But he was saying basically like he was saying, can you blame my son for doing that? Because all the cultural narratives that my son hears as a 17-year-old is that white men aren't important. And I remember thinking when he said that, I don't get any of those cultural messages. Mm-hmm. Right. But if I thought I was owed something, I would.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's it. It's you know, I mean, the there's a study that, you know, I've been thinking about that one lately because it comes up in Sheila Greger and Rebecca Lindbach's book, She Deserves Better, of the claim that resurfaces in a number of evangelical spaces that like women talk a lot, right? That like women talk twice as much as men, and like it's hard for men because like women talk twice as much as them, and like men getting tired at home. And you know, when you look at actual stuff, for one thing, men and women actually talk basically the same amount. If you look at just in studies of language, men and women actually talk the same amount every day. What actually is true, though, is that in a conversation between men and women, if you ask men afterwards, who talked the most, they always say that the women did. And they usually don't think that men and women got to talk an even amount until men are saying about four words to every one word of a woman's. That's usually how this goes, right? So, and again, it's the sense of owing. It's the sense of owing that like, it is a lens that refracts all of experience. If that is a way in which you are approaching the world, if you feel as though you should have the floor 100% of the time, then it's very frustrating when somebody has the floor a quarter of the time, right? And I think that this is the attention that, yeah, I'm totally serious. And like, and this is the thing that I think we need to, yeah. Yeah.
It's ridiculous though, right, Laura?
It is like you look at this and that's, I joke all the time that I got way more misandrist when I met my husband. That was just sort of like, what the hell are you guys all doing? Jeez, like this, you know, he turned out okay. What's your excuse? But I joke about that a lot. And I have probably become more misandrist since I got married. But that's not sincere. I obviously, this is not a, as I said, I'm not saying that this is a universal problem. I'm not saying this is a problem that is experienced evenly. You know, that like I would expect some men to go in and have an awareness accurately of how much everyone is talking. And I would expect some men to go in and never, ever, ever be able to get to a point of realizing accurately how much, you know, this is not experienced evenly. But at the same time, I think that we need to be aware that the sense of owedness is a powerful reality bending thing, right? And I think that this is something that we need to think about whenever, you know, whenever we're talking about gender and power in church. I think this is something we need to really think about, that you know it's very common to hear in these conversations the sense of like, well, you know, but men don't go to church, and it's because like nothing in church is for them, right? And I always find that very confusing from the question, like, what are you talking about? What are you?
What a revealing framing. How would it, what a revealing framing.
I know.
Right?
Yeah. And how would it not be? And then, you know, I went through this a while ago because I wrote an article about this, of just the whole sense of like, you know, church not being for men. And then, like, when you ask like what in church is for women, it's like, well, you know, they have like nursery, right? You know, it's like nursery is for children. And, you know, and also like that's a, that's a service, right? Like, this is a service that makes church going possible for women, because otherwise what usually happens is women have to take the kids out. So again, just any sense that, but I think it comes back to this sense of owedness, right? That like, we have a service at this church that makes it possible for women to go to church. Well, why isn't there a service that makes it possible for men to go to church? Well, I don't know, probably because you could sit through the whole service and nothing would disturb you, and you don't really need that, right? Unless you want someone to carry you out back if you get fussy, I don't know. But I think these are the things we need to be really realistic about, that a lot of times people say things that sound true if you adopt their lens of odinous, or if you have unconsciously glommed onto it. But when you really start to think about it and pick into pieces, like, this really doesn't make any sense, does it? So,
yeah.
What you're saying reminds me of John Piper saying that, like, the church or Christianity should have a masculine feel.
Yes.
Which
is, yeah.
Yes.
Like, yeah. What?
Yeah.
So, it doesn't? Like, look
I mean,
at the,
it's
like,
the irony
look
of John Piper saying that, right?
I know.
Yeah.
Like, look at the most downloaded sermons in the country on iTunes. Look at who has had the most, like, theological posts. Look at, like, how, what are you looking for, right? Like, what exactly, you know, yeah, that's, sorry.
It's not Christy Penley. Let me just say that.
The most downloaded people.
They're not looking.
No, yeah. No. Rebecca, you were going to say something. Go for it.
Well, I think World came out with an article and said, look, this documentary is attacking evangelicalism. It's not just attacking this niche cult. And
yeah, the Gospel Coalition said the same thing. They were taking it personally, and their focus was they're not a very charitable interpreter of Christianity. That's what they decided to focus on in this documentary.
I hate the whinging that people aren't nice enough to Christians, because, like, there's a sense of, again, entitlement, like Laura is saying. Like, there's a sense of, like, the world needs to only look at the good that we've done and just turn a blind eye to the abuses. Whereas if you're preaching the gospel, like, you're preaching about salvation from sin. So even, like, all these worst perversions then would be accepted. Like, it's accept, like, in the ATI world,
Could you say what ATI is?
Bill Gothard's homeschooling, his homeschooling program. Well, in the IBLP Gothard world, right?
Yeah.
People hear about the sexual abuse and they just blink and they say, well, you know, don't throw the baby out in the bathwater, or don't listen to gossip, or they're willing to hear these extremely perverted things and then just blink an eye. Whereas, like, kissing before marriage or some very small, like, these, like, small things that they have made into moral issues that aren't moral issues, they are projecting an extra high level of purity, so-called godliness, so-called, and then you just turn around, and if the leader does something wrong, there, you don't even, like, bother. You still believe in the teachings. You don't really care to look into it. So there's a sense of morality that is extremely warped.
Yeah.
But I wanted to say, so my research has to do with the concept of coloniality and, like, imperialism. I will say that evangelicalism in America is so embedded in the settler colonial framework that it is based on these structures. Gothard has these authority structures of, like, church, family, home. This comes from Christian Reconstructionism. So, like, similar to what Christian theonomy, like Doug Wilson's group. And they're very much, they believe in, like, top-down authority being the thing. And Wilson actually equated patriarchy and slavery. He said, slavery was a benevolent patriarchal institution. Now, that is nothing new in that framework, in that way of looking at the world, which Augustine would have written as well in City of God, chapter 16, that, like, the patriarch is in charge of the slaves to discipline them, like, by word or beating, that he is their authority to keep them from sin. He has a higher divine calling of authority. You know, they make it sound like it's such a burden, such a responsibility. And this was ingrained in the logic of the settler colonial America, the manifest destiny America, coloniality consisting of coloniality of, like, knowledge that Western society, Europeans have exclusive, like special civilized enlightened knowledge. And then in four areas, economics, capitalism, the whole system. In race, they invented the whole racial system, classifications, which is very much tied to economics, to your place in the class system is very much based on race. So like race, class, gender, and there's one more. Race, class, and gender would be the main ones. And so this is embedded very much into what America is, how America has functioned, American evangelicalism. Like some scholars, I think Marty in the 1970s wrote about how the history of the Great Awakenings and how America is essentially an evangelical empire. And if you look at imperial masculinity, if you look at hegemony and the way that they believe society should be structured, like in Christian nationalism, it's very much based on the same logics. And so the idea that Gothard is in this little corner doing some weird, crazy things, and that American evangelicalism isn't implicated in the same ideology, in the same authoritarianism, that, so like, I think the question earlier was like, where does this come from? This is a lot of nostalgia, like make America great again. Make America great again comes by, you know, maintaining its place in the world comes by maintaining that order, that Christian, so-called Christian patriarchal, white supremacist society. And that's all intertwined there in the logic of it. It's a nostalgia for the 1950s, which were in themselves is nostalgia for the age before the Manifest Destiny and the whole like cult of domesticity that was a thing. In the 1950s, and Kristen Dumais has done so much great work into this, but the cult of domesticity was such a big thing, and it was part of why America believed that like America was superior to the Soviets, that the domestic woman was an emblem of the beautiful high heel stilettos in the kitchen baking cupcakes. Like, she is an emblem of why America is better than Russia, and of like domesticity, femininity versus masculinity, the masculinity being the whole, you know, Cold War, we're going to beat them thing. And that's like a socio-political kind of history. And so people like the Pearls or Gothard or CBMW are capitalizing on that nostalgia and that longing for like this Christianized, it's with a veneer of Christianity, but of this world. And so Samuel Perry talked about it in an interview for The Flag and the Cross about how the Buffalo, New York serial killer, mass murderer, said, I'm not a Christian, but he wants to restore Europeanness, Christianness. He doesn't actually believe that Jesus is the savior, but he believes that America should be Christian. And therefore, he uses this to go out and kill people in Buffalo, New York.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, you mentioned Kristen Dumais and, you know, obviously Shiny Happy People and all, like, this is part of a constellation of sort of new, maybe popular level education about where this stuff comes from. Because I grew up in I was just texting with some friends about Shiny Happy People, and I don't have any memory of sort of being, you know, directly influenced. I don't think my family was influenced by that, but Focus on the Family, James Dobson stuff, was definitely, that was like, oh, this is important, you know, this, you know, in our family. So I think it's this constellation of this kind of new realization. And I think one of the biggest paradigm shifts for me was realizing that it's like, this stuff isn't rooted in the Bible per se. That's what they want to say is like, well, this is biblical. Look at these Bible verses, right? But it's not actually rooted in the Bible per se. Like, you study enough history and you connect these dots and you realize, oh, this is rooted in like everything you just said there, Rebecca, you know, like this is rooted in a supremacist sort of worldview that has this veneer that was, the Bible was used to support. And it was all very highly racialized, you know, highly, pegged to capitalism and capitalist concerns. And so the whole thing is all connected. And I think that's the that's the conceit that keeps needing to be revealed is, no, we're not talking about biblical anything. We're talking about, you know, like a social movement that has some Bible verses attached to it. And that's been, I don't know, I guess it's been helpful for me. The other thing that came to mind is, That's all right. A little bit of a delay, I think, Laura. So I think we're missing each other sometimes. I just wanted to say a lot of what you were saying, Laura, about people, especially white men being owed, reminds me of that. And I don't know where this quote comes from, but I've heard it. I've heard people quote it a lot, that when you're accustomed to privilege, equality feels like oppression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And that's a genuine experience, I think, that people have. I don't think people are being duplicitous when they feel put upon, you know, when white men or boys, when they feel oppressed. Like, I think it's a genuine feeling, but it comes from the fact that they have unexamined privilege that they haven't really reckoned with.
It's difficult to, some of this is also very difficult to talk about, and you want to talk about it fairly because of, you know, it is true that we live in an era where it is significantly harder for younger people to get ahead and have financial security than, you know, than their parents, right? And even then their grandparents, you know, like home ownership is much more difficult than it used to be. Wages have been stagnant for 40 years. You know, food costs are increasing, and, you know, like more and more work is concentrated in urban areas, which have much higher cost of living. So none of this is to say that people who feel disenfranchised are wrong, or people who feel right. As though they are getting the bum end of the steer are wrong. None of that is to say that this is, that is made up or neurotic or not true. The question is, what do you blame it on, right? And that's where I have a question with somebody like, you know, well, who else could I turn to but Jordan Peterson to solve this? It's like, I don't know, is Jordan Peterson talking about, you know, how we're the only country in the world that doesn't, where healthcare is not considered a right, that is, you know, that is provided socially, and that you can be bankrupted at any moment for getting sick at the wrong time, or the fact that if you are lucky enough to have health insurance, it's tied to your employer, which makes changing jobs much more difficult, which is itself a significant threat to social mobility in a culture where being promoted through the same company over a lifetime is not really a way to get ahead of anyone. No, of course they're not talking about that. No, they're talking about immigrants, and they're talking about queer people, and they're talking about women. And like, the reality is, like, they are not causing your problems. They are not causing your problems. And I don't blame people for feeling disenfranchised. What I do blame them for is not noticing that there is no get out of late capitalism fast pass by being gay. And therefore, this is not the idea that this
fast
is
pass.
Privileging
I told
you.
There, I was told there so- was. I was told there was a fast pass.
Well, there's not, unfortunately. You know, that there is nothing about being gay or being a woman that means you get to opt out of late stage capitalism, unfortunately. If there was, I would have heard about it. But more to the point that, you know, your problems are, you have more in common with the people you are blaming your problems on than you have in opposition to them. And I blame people for not noticing that, because I think that you have to have a very blinkered view of existence to not see that. So that is where I do get impatient with people. I do get impatient with people, not for saying that they that their situation is not enviable. I blame them for not, blame them a few things, actually. I resent, and I think you see this a lot with reviews of shiny, happy people. I resent people taking the, taking on the mantle of being the persecuted one, reflexively. I find that deeply frustrating, you know, that everybody, I have said this on Twitter the other day, it's like, is there any demographic that thinks they are accurately and adequately represented in the media? Like, has this ever happened that somebody is like, yeah, no, we're represented just fine, right? No, but the reality is, like, some people have much more right to complain about this than others, but it is reflective to assume the stance of, you know, I think that we live in a culture where it is often reflexive to assume the stance of a of an underdog and of a persecuted person, and not think through why you think that, or who is in your class with you, right? I don't think it would be wrong to say for if you are a 22-year-old man, a 22-year-old white man who just got out of college, I do not think you would be wrong for feeling that you are in some way in a disempowered position in human history, given what you had to spend and take on to get your college degree versus what it gets you at the end. I do have blame for people who think that the problem is immigration or feminism, right? Because it just doesn't follow.
Right.
So I think that a big thing I would just say is, you know, like, I would really urge people to think more carefully before they think of themselves as the underdog of why do you think that? And who do you think put you in that position? Right? Because that matters. What is the evidence for this? Yeah.
And I think we miss then our true solidarities then on the other side of that, right? If we blame the wrong people, we don't realize that if I'm a 22-year-old man, I actually have a lot of solidarity with women, with black people, with queer people. Mm-hmm. Like, that's where it's a solidarity that, that I'm missing out on, actually.
Yeah.
If we're missing some of those things. So.
Yeah. You don't have anything in common with Donald Trump. He doesn't care what happens to you, right? You're missing the ones
who
the fact that you share a race and gender is not relevant. So I think I started down this path and I can't remember what got me onto it. But I think I think those are the things to be thinking about when we think about, like, where do these cultures come from and why do they have such staying power? We're obviously far afield from shiny, happy people in some ways in this, but I think more to the point that, talking about shiny, happy people to the exclusion of related subjects is, I think, a mistake. I think the important thing to note here is that this is, part of why this is familiar is because even if the movement itself is not familiar to, or if you're not in a religious context, that these ways of insisting on hierarchy and these ways of valorizing and treating them as necessities that without which our culture shall surely vanish. I think those are secular phenomena too. And those are things we just need to be thinking about and aware of.
We'll be right back.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, our 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn how to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life that God shares with us. It is a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying out some new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it's helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show.
If y'all go to the last, so Bill Gothard's basic seminar, his infamous seminar is available for free online. Not that anyone really needs to put themselves through that. I'm not recommending it at all. But in his very last session of the seminar, he basically outlines Christian nationalism as an agenda. Mm-hmm. And he says this. Mm-hmm. He says, what happens is that before all these, you know, the sexual revolution, everything, that society fell apart. It's always the conservative narrative, right? Mm-hmm. Society fell apart. Well, initially it resisted it. And then what it resists, it will take on. So he's saying if we create this new standard, this new revised standard of biblical, conservative families, whatever term he used to define it. You create, and then he was like, you create this thing, society will, and then he'll draw like a jagged line. Society will react to it, and then they're gonna accept it, and then it's going to become the dominant thing. It will become the mainstream thing in American society, and that is what it is. If you go to his current website, he's talking about, you know, the Holy Founding Fathers and everything, like the Christian nationalist thing is very much, they won't use the term, you know, but that is why they have that many kids. It's because they want to outnumber everyone else, and they want to create a world where they are the majority, and they're willing to work with whoever, even if they don't match up, you know, the dress standards or whatever else. They're willing to work with anyone who will support that agenda.
Yeah. Yeah, we could get into replacement theory there. We could get into the anti-science that runs through this. We could get into all kinds of things. I really appreciate the color that both of you are bringing to this, meaning the backstory, the history, the cultural artifacts that bring something that maybe some of us want to see as an anomaly, as something that is actually a quintessential picture of white Christian culture, that there's a lot of tethers to our experience. Maybe as we turn to wrap up this particular conversation, I know a lot of my friends, our listeners, there's been a reckoning in their faith. Like, they're really having a hard time because they keep seeing the ills or the evils, the pathologies of their faith, and they're trying to hold on to something. And that, you know, and then, you know, am I going to hold on to, you know, authoritarianism? No, I can't hold on to that. Am I going to hold on to the husband is the head of the wife? No, that's abusive. You know, and so there's all these different things. So I guess, Rebecca, Laura, as we close here, why are you still a Christian? And what is the work that you want to do in this morass we're talking about as a Christian? What's the Christian work to do?
I have a slogan I live by that I heard at a lecture when I was a junior in college. I cannot for the life of me remember this man's name. He was a guest lecturer at college, and he was he was talking about a range of social issues and the way they interacted with Christianity. And he said he had, this was not his slogan, he had heard it from someone else. He said that if it ever seems that you must choose between truth and God, choose truth, and the truth will lead you back to God. And that was a phrase that hit me about as hard as it possibly could have, because it perfectly cohered with my experience. That I was learning more about the Bible, I was learning more about the world and myself and what made sense for me and how to process my own experiences being hurt in the church. And I was increasingly coming to the end of, you know, the evangelical narrative that evangelicalism is the ability to answer every question concisely off the top of your head, right? Which I think is sort of a cultural expectation, you know, being able to explain why God allows things, bad things to happen to good people over any dinner conversation on a napkin, right? Like that sort of like, you know, cultural narrative of having all the answers. It was exactly what I needed to hear. And I have kind of stuck with that my entire life, that whenever I feel constrained by my faith to believe something that I really know isn't true on a gut level, or just doesn't seem like it can possibly be true, that's where I go. And it is proven true that God actually is where the truth is. And by insisting he's another way, I think people use that to get power over other people and deceive them and trick them and get them to buy into systems that aren't helping them. So I think that would be the primary thing I would say to people is, I would expect to meet God where the truth is. And if something seems to you that it must be true, or something seems to you that it must be false, don't resist that feeling and keep leaning into it and keep pressing into it and talk about it and bring in friends who have thoughts about it. And and don't constrain yourself. You know, I think sometimes churches say that, you know, we love when people ask questions. We're not saying that you can't ask questions, but we do expect you to arrive at this answer in a reasonable amount of time. And I think, like, get people in your life who don't put that expectation on you, and be okay with exploring. Because I don't think that path means that you will not have a faith anymore. In fact, I know from experience that's not true. I think that would be my primary advice. It's not as dire as it seems to start questioning and walking away from these things. The other much less poetic thing I would say is just pull out a history book and read about the ancient Near East and read about the Roman Empire and get a sense of how these things are informing the New Testament and the Old Testament and how far apart these cultures are from our own and how far the cosmology and the worldview is. Because I think that one thing that made a huge difference for me was having permission to acknowledge that we got on the theme of, you know, calling things biblical and when they actually have origins in American history. You know, I think one way to even do one better is just look at how irretrievable and how much you wouldn't want to retrieve the culture of the Roman Empire, right? That, like, there are the way in which family and marriage and childhood is conceived in the ancient world is just so far from ours. And if you feel as though it's difficult and burdensome to try to recreate these structures in your own life because that's biblical, guess what? You're never going to reconstruct it because you have running water and you have no idea how much that changes the way you think about what a family is when you're not walking up the street every day to get a bucket, right? And that, like, you know, like this, it sounds small, but it's not. It changes the way you think about a family if your house is porous, if it is semi-public, if you have a porch that people are just allowed to be on who live in your neighborhood, if you are a part of a guild, if you don't have windows, if all your kids sleep in your bed with you. This is going to really change the way you think about things like marriage and childhood and family and what your family is and who you owe allegiance to. And if you feel like you're being oppressed by trying to live up to biblical womanhood, guess what? You're not even close. You're not even close to being a woman the way that it was in the Bible. So give yourself permission to just be okay with that and just accept that if, in light of the fact that if God wanted you to live like a woman in the Roman Empire, he wouldn't have let 2,000 years since then pass, would he? So just be okay with the fact that these are historical things and we don't need to try to recreate them.
Yes. Stop gaslighting yourself and give yourself a hug. I like it. I like it. Rebecca, how about for you? What's the work we need to do if we see these things and we want to change them?
One thing that comes to mind is that we have talked about the political and social context in the world in which fundamentalism occurs, in which these extreme Christians are operating. The only language that they speak is like biblicism and devotionalism. They will not understand bringing in sociology or history to show where this comes from. They'll just say, but the Bible, but devotion. And so before I went through a period of rethinking my faith because we had been exposed to not just this, but other extreme movements that were about the taking evangelicalism to its logical extremes, which is being sold out for God, being devoted to God, reading your Bible for hours and praying for hours a day and not seeking the things of the world and being separated from the world. And a lot of, like, I would say mainstream evangelicalism has this as the ideal, but it's the extremists and fundamentalists who actually take that to its full logical, like, who actually are zealous and radical enough to try to live out that ideal of this on fire for God, you know, sell everything, make your children's education completely about the Bible because everything else is of the world, etc., etc. And Yeah, that is something that we have to realize is rotten at its core. It is emotionally unhealthy. It often ends up in abuse. Two examples that I can give, and people might not be aware of this, Elizabeth Elliot was heavily involved mm-hmm. in IBLP. She taught at their mm-hmm. women's seminar. She literally told women that God created you to be a doormat. You should be the best doormat you can be. And so she helped groom these young women into the servile, submissive ideal. And it was all based on this whole thing that she and Jim Elliot had, which was like, sell all, you know, risk everything for God, go the hundreds and like go to like not just 100% but beyond. And then the other people who are heavily promoting this ideal is Eric and Leslie Ludi. And if you go to Embassy Institute, which is the IBLP version of Netflix, where they have all their teachings and seminars, you will find Eric and Leslie Ludi speaking at IBLP conferences mm-hmm. to this day, because that is the kind of Christianity that IBLP promotes, that Christianity that is about radical devotion to God and radical biblicism, when we know that we know by its fruit and we know by the toxicity and harm of these teachings, what they do to you spiritually, internally, emotionally, physically. It is, there's something very wrong. And then I stepped away from all, like, you know, we were taught to, like, it is through Bill Gothard's teachings and through, like, the homeschool groups that we had that we learned, like, how to study the Bible, memorize entire books of it, read it through in a month and do all these things, like, you know, make vows to read your Bible how many hours a day or whatever. I stepped away from all that devotionalism and all that, like, for a while, because I started seeing people just turn a blind eye to abuse, whether it was domestic violence or Bill Gothard's behavior and sexual abuse. And people just, like, people who said they were all about holiness and radicalism just like whatever, just looked away.
Yeah.
And the biggest message that I would have is, when you look at all these things that are shaking the church today, I believe it's God. I believe God is the one who uncovers literal mm-hmm. sin. And I would say, don't look away. Mm. Don't try to shield yourself into this thing where, oh, these were good people, they're preaching good things, this helped really help my faith, and therefore all these other, like, the cognitive dissonance that they will say that all the accusations therefore must somehow not be real. And so you buckle down and live in a fantasy world where, say, Ravi Zacharias or Gothard or whoever else was your, you know, the one that you looked up to, the celebrity, and or in your church or whatever movement that it is, don't look away from abuse. I think Jesus very much cares about that. Like, this, why am I Christian? Because I believe Jesus cares about this, that Jesus is angrier about it than I am, that Jesus knows the suffering of all the abuse victims more than I do, that I believe in that pursuit of holiness, radical holiness for the church, which must mean taking a strong stand against not just the abuse, but the teachings that have led mm-hmm. to and caused abuse.
Yeah.
And so I'm really passionate about justice. And, you know, justice is a trigger word with evangelicals these days. And I realized it's because they do pursue social justice. They are pouring millions into their version of social justice because they believe that God's justice is synonymous with creating an earthly government that aligns and then using that top-down force. Everything is about dominance and force. To me, it's a religion of, like, secularized cultural power. And so that's their anything. So top-down justice is their thing. And so they hate any kind of justice that comes from the bottom. There's no such thing as Jesus mm-hmm. caring for the marginalized, the abused, the least, the lowest, lost. Mm. No, because it all has to come through the top, through power, through becoming a majority in society, and et cetera. But I believe that, I mean, I'm not calling for a revolution or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. I believe that the justice happens when God's righteousness starts in the church. And when we and when we actually live out what Jesus taught.
So we're all social justice Christians, is what you're saying, right?
Can I actually make one last point?
Let's just be honest about it.
Yeah. Well, I'll just say, just like washing each other's feet is a radical act of toppling down the social hierarchy.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead, Laura.
Oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't trying to cut off Rebecca. First I made her speak, then I made her stop. Sorry about that, Rebecca. But if there's anyone listening to this who, I think sometimes these things come down in stages, right? That and if there's anyone listening to this who sees the abuses and sees the harms and sees maybe some of the veneer, but you're not quite willing to give up on this. You feel this deep connection or the sense that the most important thing is this project of creating this Christian church and this idea that this Christian nation and this idea that if you have a bunch of kids and you homeschool them and you don't let them date or and you don't and you arrange their marriages and then they have big homeschooled families that like one day we're going to take over the U.S. Having a bunch of kids is, I'm saying this because I'm a practical person and sometimes I think there's more than one way in, and I would say that a possible way into this is the reality of what you say, what you're being told to do and what is going to result. And having a bunch of homeschooled kids who will then grow up to be religious conservatives and taking over America is like having five kids, because then they're going to be the starting lineup from the Bulls. And this is how you're going to retire when they make tons of money. That like you have no power over what your children will become. There is no power on earth or heaven that will make your kids be who you want them to be, because they have minds of their own. And as much as you can box them in, you can squeeze it, you can draw walls, you can throw up boundaries, you cannot change who a child is going to become. I really think that, you know, and people love to quote the, you know, train a child in the way that they, in the way they should go. And when they're old, they won't depart from it. Sometimes that happens, but you know, straight people raise gay kids, gay people raise straight kids. People, Democrats have conservative kids have these things. You don't have power over this. And I think that if you're not at a point yet where you're really ready to start interrogating the project, at least be realistic of what is actually going to result from this. And I think that it's important to note that you can't muscle your way through a child's psyche to make them the person you want them to be. It's not going to happen. Like, look at the Duggars, you know? This is not going the way they thought it would, I don't think, right? You know, they've got a daughter who has all but entirely defected from the family and is highly critical of them. And then the heir apparent to the Duggar political empire is facing more than a decade in prison for child abuse, possessing sexual assault material of children. And I think that, you know, I don't know, maybe check out Dune from your local library. It's a great book, and it's all about the inability of protocols to constrain the whims of the human heart. And it's a good lesson. It's a good lesson. So,
yeah. Well, I appreciate Dr. Laura. I had to call you Dr. Laura at least once. Rebecca, for being here. The work you're doing.
Soon to be doctor.
Yes, soon to be doctor.
A while yet.
Yes, but we're gonna speak it into existence.
There we go.
Yeah, the work you're doing among disciplines, in your own disciplines, is really helpful for us. We need mothers who can help us make sense of confusing things. And so, thanks for your writing, your time. Real quick, just once again, if people want to connect with you in the virtual space, where can they do that? Rebecca, what's the best place to find your writings and to interact with you? Oh, we can't hear you, Rebecca.
My Twitter, I think it's Mui Rebecca, and my Medium is Rebecca Mui, and kingdomoutpost.org.
Yeah. And how about for you, Laura?
My Twitter is at Laura RBSNS. What, shoot, gosh darn. Okay, it's Robinson without the vowels, okay? So it's Laura RBNSN. Okay, got it. And my Substack is at the top of that page, and there's also a link on my profile to my... if you want to do more listening of like academic New Testament material and get more familiar with biblical scholarship, I also co-host the podcast New Testament Review with Ian Mills, who also got his doctorate at Duke, and we go over classic pieces of New Testament scholarship just to familiarize people with the New Testament field. I also sometimes byline on Apocalypse Here. That's also on Twitter. That's my husband's podcast, and we have some stuff coming out soon. So those are, if you want to get involved in the fledgling Laura Robinson media empire, there are a lot of different ways to do it. So.
Well, as somebody who's benefited a great deal from your Medium site, Rebecca, and your Substack, Laura, I highly recommend those both. And then if you, like me, want to read New Testament scholarship or learn about it, but you don't have $143 to purchase the academic book, let Ian and Laura give you the summary for free. Thanks again for being on the podcast. Or see if they'll buy it for you. Thanks for being on the podcast today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so the we had Dr. Robinson, Dr. Laura, and Rebecca on the podcast to talk about shiny, happy people. But halfway through that podcast, I thought we should just have them on to talk about reality.
Right.
I'm in love with Rebecca's PhD about the intersection of politics and all that stuff. And then the way that Laura thinks really lights me up. How was that for you guys?
It was good. I felt like we needed like a 4-part series because there were lots of questions that we actually didn't get to.
I know.
So, you know.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we've talked about is, you know, in our forthcoming sort of membership platform is maybe taking our time and, you know, just a few of us kind of walking through each episode and maybe taking some time to kind of unpack some of that stuff. Cause I felt the same thing that it's very dense. You know, both Laura and Rebecca are either have completed PhDs or working on PhDs. And so they sort of bring a veritable cornucopia of knowledge and background to this stuff that I think is probably still very new for a lot of our listeners. And so listeners that you may have felt sort of like you were drinking from a fire hose. And that's, you know, you were. So that's why it feels that way. There's just a ton there. But I think the fact that we veered so far from the content of the documentary, mm-hmm. I think is evidence that I think it's basically an exhibit of why this documentary is, I guess maybe people are talking about it as much as they are. I think there are connections being made to a lot of things that people didn't realize maybe were, you know, where they were rooted or, you know, didn't realize that, hey, what I grew up thinking was biblical Christianity is just super socially, racially, you know, economically constructed.
Culturally compromised, right?
It's just a reflection
of the culture.
Yeah. It's not ancient. It's not, you know, biblical in that way. It's just, you know, and so I think it's just, yeah, it's rattling a lot of people. So.
You know, it's interesting because we didn't even get into this. And actually, we haven't even talked about this, the three of us. But, you know, a week ago or so, the Southern Baptist Convention, like, had a vote, right? And they voted women who were pastors out. Like, right. You're no longer a pastor. Yeah. And it's fascinating to me. It's been, I mean, we're recording this, you know, a week and a half later. But I have not posted about it because there's something tender in my heart about the fact that a group of people are slow to admit abuse, like when it happens, and slow to allow women to have any kind of leadership position. And that says something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like wrestling with it in my own, within my own life of just like friends and family that have been impacted by women pastors, whatever. Anyway, it just made me think of like within women as a whole, like there has just been such mistreatment.
Yeah.
This is like a gross generalization, but there's a wrestling. There's an untangling for me within this documentary, with like how I grew up, with what's coming out in culture and in different denominations. Like it feels like it's kind of showing its ugly face in lots of different places. Totally. Am I alone in that?
No. Totally.
You're not alone. No.
Yeah, Christy, I had a SBC pastor friend who said to me, the reality is we do not have the interest in policing sexual predators, right, but we do have the interest in policing women pastors.
Yeah.
And what he's naming is that this isn't about faithfulness or principle. This is about how patriarchy works.
Yeah.
So that you're more bothered by a woman proclaiming the gospel.
Yep.
Than you are a pastor grooming children.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is what I mean by, Rebecca and Laura both said, tell the truth about it. Yeah. Look at it. Don't look away. Yes. Don't get mad at the messenger, you know? Mm-hmm. Don't critique the documentary for being unfair to Christianity when the documentary is telling survivors, we see you. Mm-hmm. What happened to you is wrong. Like, that's the important thing here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think over and over again, we just have to give each other permission to tell the truth and to tell Christians that, you know, want to police women pastors but not sexual predators, hey, knock it off, buddy.
Yep.
Knock it off.
Yeah. I appreciated, and you know, I have a heart for, too, I think, for people who feel very disoriented because their faith, you know, their faith was so bound up in these forms and this theology that they don't know what it would mean to tell the truth about this. And like, how do I hang on to God and tell the truth about this? So I so appreciated I just wanted to emphasize it and say it again, what Laura said, that the advice that she got from some mentor in the past, that if you ever feel like you have to choose between God and the truth, choose the truth, and it will eventually lead you back to God.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't mean to give you more work, Ben, but I wonder if at the end of the show notes, we can just have some resources. She mentioned She Deserves Better as a good book, but I was thinking like, we have lots of examples of things not to read. And so what do we read? What do we look at? And I just wonder if there's like a handful of things we can put up there.
I sent you an article on Baptist News by a past guest of the podcast, Rick Pidcock. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a really good article about how a lot of the dynamics we see in this documentary, it connects the dots. So,
All right. Well, both of y'all tend to give me work to do. So I don't know what to think about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm
trying to get work off my plate.
Yeah.
But I'm probably going to
put that stuff up sabbatical.
There. I know. Well, it's just a sabbatical from church work. So which makes it a little, you know, I'm not. Thankfully, Matt's giving me no church work to do.
Yeah,
good work, Matt.
Sabbatical. None.
Way to go.
None.
Except I did have to get the website fixed. The website crashed.
Yeah, it did crash.
But it was all right. It took me 2 minutes.
I know you got to run, Christy, but knock, knock.
Who's there?
Hike.
Hike who?
Unsuspecting Christy. Matt, waiting with bated breath, sets the perfect trap.
And the minute I said, haiku, I was like, here he goes. Here he goes. He wrote
it's happening.
One.
There's a haiku coming.
I love it.
Isn't that a good one?
That's a good one. All right, friends. Well, I got to go take one of my kids to work. So,
whoa.
Peace out, everybody.
I need to go hang out with friends and my daughter here in Austin, Texas.
Fun. I'm going to go work. I'm holding it down while Ben's gallivanting across the country.
Thanks, Matt. Get some work done.
I will.
Maybe if you could get some of my work done while I'm having fun with friends.
I'll send you some more links to put in the show notes.
Okay. All right. Peace, y'all.
All right. See ya.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. If you're finding it helpful or enjoyable, we'd love it if you'd tell your friends about it.
Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And you can join our Gravity community online for free at gravityleadership.com/join.
You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as our email most Fridays with curated links to articles we find interesting and helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join.
Our podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the show. You can check out his work at aaronsternke.com.
We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravityleadership.com/message and click the Start Recording button.
You can also email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.